Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is a very well-recognized authority on back pain, Dr. Stuart McGill. Dr. McGill is professor of spine biomechanics at the University of Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. He's one of those guys that the orthopedic guys go to when they want to understand the problems that are going on in the back for us human beings. Our goal today is to discuss the origins of back pain, and particularly low back pain, its prevention and its rehabilitation. And if we have time, we'll get into some of the issues about core training for peak performance among athletes. Many of our listeners should pick up some tips on back pain with this program. You can reach us during the program with your questions and comments. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. McGill, it's a pleasure to talk with you before the program and to have you on Line 1. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, well, thank you, Dr. Woodward. Good afternoon to all folks.
Tell us a little bit about your training and experience. I kind of want to make sure everybody realizes from the get-go you're not a physician, but it sounds like to me you do a lot of clinical work.
Well, it's a very strange story. I started my PhD in spine biomechanics. That was 31 years ago now, I guess. And did work on spine injury mechanisms and things like that. And then after I graduated, I would get asked to go to clinical meetings, and I would describe mechanisms of injury and the like. And the orthopods and neurologists would ask, would you see a patient for us? We think what you just described would be very relevant. And I would say, well, no, I don't see patients. I'm not a trained clinician. And they said, well, don't worry, we'll be there. Would you come? And so I would start to see patients with them as a consultant. And lo and behold, I realized that an approach based on the mechanism of injury and therefore how do you avoid the mechanism and how could you address it in a therapeutic sense was helpful to them. And they kept asking me. And in the interim, now medical schools ask, would I come in? They're going to present me with three patients to see in front of their staff and fellows and students and whatnot. And show them how to assess from this mechanical perspective. So that's a long-winded answer, I guess, to your question, but it's been a sort of a funny journey.
Yeah, what's interesting is, I mean, it's clearly an evidence-based model. You've done right laboratory research on understanding and thinking about the results of what you see, and it's really, certainly as I read your research and the books you've written, that it's changed my mind, and I suspect it's driving a lot of modern physical and orthopedic therapy as well.
Well, I wish I could agree with you in that it is really changing practice, but I
okay.
don't know how effective we are with the changing bit.
Right.
But
it takes a long time to get people to change. I mean, there's actually been research on that where we and I hope, and I definitely want to get into your thoughts about it, but it's frustrating. But it seems to me that those people who are really in the know of what's happening, what you're saying seems to, and what you've discovered, it's more than what you just say, is what you've discovered really makes a lot of sense.
Well, I think so.
Let's explore that. We've got a phone call and an email already, and it's a common problem. So I want to make sure we get some basic information down so you can start answering questions as they come in. What is it about the back that we need to understand? It's very difficult to tell people and show people the anatomy over the phone, but I know you're interviewed a lot. Perhaps you can do that. And then explain how you address back pain. How do you approach somebody with back pain as a consequence of this?
Okay. Well, if we go back to the anatomical, biomechanical basis for it all, The issue with the spine is this. We have this structure, a very wonderful structure, that is a stack of bones, a vertical stack of vertebra. Now, if you were designing, if you were an engineer and you could come up with a design of a rod that was vertical, that was to bear load, you would build a rigid I-beam or something like that that wouldn't bend, it wouldn't buckle when you applied compressive load on it. But if I said, now take a stack of oranges, stack them up, five, one on top of the other, and put a load on the top, and what's going to happen? The oranges will just roll apart. So right away we see a paradox of structure. On one hand, you have a flexible rod, but no engineer would design a flexible vertical rod to bear a compressive load. So now you need a system, a stabilizing system, and let's use the system of the ligaments and the muscles to create a guy wire system. And that guy wire system, if it is tensioned appropriately, will then allow the spine to bear compressive loads, shear loads, and bending loads, but it also allows mobility that allows us to tie our shoes and throw a ball and run and all the rest of it. So here we have this structure that does it all. It has to be mobile, but it has to be stable. It has to absorb shock, but it has to be rigid. It needs elastic tuning. When you measure performance both of very basic functions, and I'll use walking for that, and also high-performance functions, I should have backed up to say I don't see the average person with bad back. My specialty really is the very disabled backs, the failed backs, as it's known in medical circles. And I also see the opposite end of the spectrum, which are the elite performers. Both require expertise, realizing that we're dancing on the knife edge. You can't make a mistake with either. Where you can probably, there's a bit more of a margin for error. In the middle ranks of back pain. So having said all of that, let's go back to, say, a child. You're a pediatrician. Say you have a child with a neurologic disorder where the quadratus lumborum muscle is not receiving full neural drive. It's got some sort of paralysis, perhaps. The first thing that child has great difficulty with is walking, because in order to walk, in order to create leg swing, you have to stiffen the pelvis, because if you stand on one leg, the pelvis drops to the swing leg side. Well, the hip musculature assists with that, but so does the core stiffness. So if you don't have core stiffness, in this specific example, a lateral core provided by quadratus lumborum and the abdominal obliques, you can't walk. So there's an example of where you have to seek this magical blend of all these mechanical features just to allow you to walk. But then we go to the other end, where you will have, say, take a world-class sprinter. If you notice, all of those world-class sprinters have tremendous lordosis, or a big hollow in their low back. And that structure is designed for high-end running speed. It tilts the pelvis around so that the hip extensor power production is driven through the gait cycle to propel you forward. Then compare that with, say, one of these UFC fighters, which are becoming very popular these days as a sport, and you'll see these fellows, they can have the ability to kick one another in the head. And what you'll notice is not one of them have a lot of lordosis in their back, but rather they have a very flat back, right, which allows them to kick with the pelvis flexed forward very high. But don't ask any of them to run, because they're very poor at it, and it's quite comical. So there are three different examples of where the structure determines the function. They all have to live and do these things of daily function. But the understanding, you would train each one of those differently, you would avoid back pain in each one of those very differently. Anyway, that's probably an opening between the link of anatomy, mechanics, function, rehab.
Yeah. I think that was helpful. And for most of us, the idea, well, I think we all realize that certain things that we do not help prevent problems like sitting all the time, not exercising enough, getting overweight? Those are things that come to my mind, whether I'm right or wrong, I want you to answer. But what is it that we're doing as a population for the most part that is not helpful and actually maybe detrimental to our back health?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. Sitting too much in our modern society is I don't know if it's the number one problem or not, but it's certainly a very dominant problem. Some people believe that sitting is quite a benign activity for the back. Well, as it turns out, it isn't. Your listeners might appreciate this story. We all know the couch potato who can sit all day long watching television, sit at work and whatnot, and they never complain about a bad back. And yet there are others who will, they'll go to the gym every day, they'll work out for an hour or so, and it's so unfair because they can only tolerate sitting for half an hour or so, and then they start getting this background chronic grumpiness in their back, and they wonder why. Well, the virgin back or the virgin disc, one that's never been traumatized or overly worked, paradoxically, it will tolerate the stresses of sitting quite well. But someone who goes to the gym every day and they do a few deadlifts and leg presses and squats and whatnot, slowly loosen up, if I can use that term, the lower discs. And if you add compression and repeated bending, that's the mechanism that initiates disc bulges. And now once you've initiated the process of that disc bulge, and it's just a function of cumulative trauma and cumulative loading, unbeknownst to the person because it mm-hmm. doesn't cause them any pain. Mm-hmm. But what it does is it takes away their resilience to now sit statically with a flexed spine and have the mild compression associated with sitting, so now it becomes intolerable after an hour or so. So it's almost paradoxical in that you can't train to be a better sitter. In fact, the more you train, paradoxically, it reduces the ability to sit.
But
sitting's a problem.
Right, right. And this idea, the other major thing I've got from researching this is this idea of flexion and extension of the back is, taking your example of oranges, those oranges are getting crushed and mashed and moved around, and those discs we have, although they're not the same kind of structure, they're getting manipulated and injured and, as you say, the delaminated. I don't know if you want to get into the structure. And so eventually those discs fail. And I'm a prime example. I grew up playing sports. I was doing lots of flexion stuff. I did lots of sit-ups because I was told that would strengthen my abdominal muscles. And what I'm hearing now is that's not what we ought to be doing, particularly for athletes or anybody. We need to think about those oranges and how they're getting mashed and do more core strengthening to protect those areas.
Yeah. Well, consider this. Let's take an orange seed between our thumb and our finger, and we want to squeeze the orange seed and direct it in a certain direction. Mm-hmm. You bias the squeezing force to get it to go out a certain way.
Right.
Well, this is exactly what we do with the discs of our back. As we flex forward, hydraulically, it squeezes the viscous nucleus posteriorly. Mm-hmm. And the listenership, I'm assuming the listenership is primarily a medical audience or...
Primarily not medical office, primarily general public.
Okay. Well, the rings that form the outside of the disc are strands of collagen. And as you repeatedly flex the spine, it creates this hydraulic stress on the nuclear gel in the middle, and it splits these fibers apart. And that's what Dr. Woodard is referring to when he talks about delamination. This repeated bending, and you can bend a lot with no force, and that's not really a problem. But if you bend and then have all of the added muscle force from the abdominal muscles in sit-ups, or if you're doing repeated picking up Olympic bars off the floor, for example, this nucleus slowly delaminates the collagen fibers and works its way through the cracks that appear in the delaminations until you get a buildup of the nucleus just underneath the surface of the disc. Now we've got a bulge occurring, and then if the repeated nature of the movement continues, that will eventually extrude and trap a nerve root. But the key to it all is movement patterns.
Okay.
If we were to bend over, instead of flexing through the spine, flex through the hips, and it's called a hip hinge. Do you want me to explain the mechanics of that? It's really quite simple.
Please do.
Okay. Think of this as a drill, and I hope I can explain it over the radio that folks will create a visual image of this. We call it the shortstop squat. So if you're a baseball player, imagine viewing a shortstop waiting in the infield for the batter to hit the ball. Stand, put your hands on your thighs, and slide your hands down your thighs and grab your knees. Your buttocks and pelvis should have moved back. Now pull your knees over your feet. Your hands are grabbing your knees, now you're in this shortstop squat position. Now, think of the curvature in your back. Try and get that hollow in your low back that you have when you're standing. So adopt that when you're in the shortstop squat. Now, instead of lifting with your back, envision sliding your hands up your thighs by pulling your hips forward, but don't move your back. Now, there is a shortstop squat which grooves all of the motion being about the hip. And what I've just described is what Olympic weightlifters utilize to pick enormous loads up off the ground with really very little risk to their back because they're lifting with their hips. Mm-hmm. There's a myth that you should lift with your legs and not your back. In fact, more correctly, it's lift with your hips and not your back. But if you image pulling your hips through, it really is a very protective strategy for this disc pathology, very specific disc pathology that we were describing earlier.
Okay. So a lot of what I'm hearing is it's related to really keeping that mobility, you know, not flexing that that back too much. I think it's something that you read that we have limited number of really bends in those discs, and we're wearing them out, and that most of what we're doing on a daily basis should be trying to not allow that bending to happen too much, and then rehab is, if I'm saying it right, you work on not only that, but strengthen it and looking at what patterns people have set up that may be increasing their risk of pain.
I have to comment first. Can sure. I call you Thad?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is it so formal, Dr. Witter?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that boy, you've done your homework. That was fantastic, because when you look at the design of the core muscles, they're different than muscles of the limbs, in that muscles of the limbs are designed to create movement, and that's exactly the way they should be trained. Muscles of the core are designed to stop movement when you analyze them functionally and anatomically, and again, that's how they should be trained. So they follow different rules. But you're exactly right. The disc is a fatigable structure. If you had a coat hanger and you wanted to break it and you didn't have wire cutters, you'd bend the coat hanger back and forth. The metal would fatigue and it would break.
Right.
Well, this is what people do to the beam, the bending wire of their spine, if you bend it over again. But I've been really misquoted on this particular aspect. Some people say, well, I listened to McGill and I stopped doing flexion and I got weak and ran into troubles. Well, they never understood what I was trying to say, so maybe I'll take this opportunity to clarify. Yeah. When we talk about your spine has only so many bends before it breaks to injury, it's bends multiplied by the accompanying load. So if you were to take a belly dancer, for example, who bends their spine around a lot, they don't have any load. They're standing upright and they just have the body weight. So that's not what we're talking about. But when you couple bending your spine with a lot of load, like when you're picking up a barbell, for example, or you're picking your baby out of the crib at 2 o'clock in the morning for a feeding. These are spine bends with a lot of load. Now, your spine can only take so many of those.
Gotcha.
But again, the prophylactic or the prevention is when you're under load, make sure your spine is in a neutral position and you use the core muscles to stop motion, make your core rigid, and then lift with the hips.
Okay. We have a couple of callers, and a caller and an email. And before I take those, let me just remind listeners once again, this is Line 1, your health connection. And my guest today is Dr. Stuart McGill. Dr. McGill is a professor of spine biomechanics at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. And I think it's fair to say a world authority on spine biomechanics, and is often asked to speak from a clinical standpoint about problems. And I'm sure a lot of our calls today will be related to clinical issues, and I'm going to let you address those, but however you want to edit what you say, you feel free to do that, okay?
Thank you.
Jonathan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm glad to hear from you. I am a person who is recently retired after 2 years from the military, and I was very active. Lately, I've been doing a lot of what you were talking about before, the couch sitting and whatnot, and I've noticed now I have severe back pain. I had it right in the upper right area. It seems to have traveled to just my ribs on the right side. I still have a lower back pain. And I don't know what to do about it. I've never had this problem before.
Well, do I take a shot at it?
Yeah, whatever you feel like saying here.
Well, your listeners are going to be disappointed because this isn't like, say, having a cold or something like that where there is a standard answer. The problem with backs is everybody has a slightly different cause for their pains. And without seeing a person and doing a proper assessment, I don't think anybody could give advice. And if someone is giving you advice, as we all see on the internet, I would ignore it.
I would rather just hear the commentary that you had, but I think you did hit upon something before where you said you had people who weren't used to being a couch potato and suddenly started doing it. I found a lot of time on my hand and was watching a lot of TV.
Well, you're not doing yourself a favor. In fact, you're actually stealing your resilience for tolerating other activities. So I can give you a general advice there, and that is to be cognizant of the time that you're sitting. Think about should you really be sitting on a soft couch? You'd probably be a lot better off on a firmer surface with some lumbar support, number one. And number two, have a exercise program designed by someone who knows what they're doing for you, and do it every day. And I think you'll find you'll be enjoying a much more pain-free life.
How do people go about finding someone that is reliable about exercise programs and physical therapy related to, let's say, just back pain? Is there a way you would suggest people approach that?
Well, I get asked that a lot, this may sound arrogant or self-serving, but it's my honest answer. The first thing you have to do is stop the cause.
Right.
And you need someone with expertise to point out to you what that cause is. Now, who is that person? That person, it could be your family doc, but I highly doubt it. They, as a rule, most of them do not have that expertise. There's a lot of good physical therapists, chiropractors, so there's some massage therapists. There's all sorts of people who have movement expertise that can help with that. Then to do an assessment sufficient to come up with the most appropriate therapeutic program, I know you're well aware of our approach, but what we do is what's called provocative testing. We actually provoke the patient to try and understand what makes their symptoms worse. And we use combinations of different motions, postures, and loads. And it points out to the patient very precisely what the pain triggers are. Then they know what to avoid. It's a very precise diagnosis in that they know very precisely what to avoid and then what to do to avoid those mechanisms. So if it's more hip hinging, okay, then you mobilize the hips, probably do core stiffening exercises, etc. So there's just an example. But then there are other people, oh, well, they might have radiating symptoms from perhaps a disc pinching the L4 nerve root, to be very specific and precise. Well, again, there are certain movement exercises that would avoid the cause and provide good corrective therapy. Who is that person? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. What I suggest to people is I'm fairly well known in the corrective exercise and therapy world. I would say, well, do you know McGill's textbook? And if they say yes, well, I would think that that person probably has a pretty good idea on how to organize effective provocative testing to understand the mechanical cause of pain. But then again, you still, at somewhere along the line, probably need that to see that family doc, because once in a while, you're going to get that patient who the root cause of their back pain is a tumor or something really sinister. And
right.
Of course, you've got
right.
to rule out all of these things as well.
Right.
So it's sort of a team. I would start with your family doc, but then you're going to have to hunt around for a person who understands the mechanical cause, if in fact that's what it is.
Okay.
I wish it could be more directive.
No. Well, I think that's...
I can't.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think for all of us, we always wish it was easier than it is a lot of times. But what I hear you saying is similar to something I saw written on the internet, and you may want to... want to edit this, but it says McGill's approach can be summarized in his treatment algorithm of 5 steps. Assess the patient to determine the faulty movements, correct the faulty movement patterns, and sustain the movement pattern to sustainable movement patterns. Build endurance in the muscle groups involved in producing excellent quality of movement. Improve agility and strength in the good movement patterns. And then finally, add power to these movements. Right, it just makes sense when you hear something like this, and I hope somebody's not not misrepresenting you. But is that also a comparable with what you're trying to say?
Well, whoever quoted that, they have it pretty well it.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's very logical, isn't it?
Well, that's what I tell you. For me, has done this for 10 years, and as being a physician, when you start reading certain things, you notice there's an unbelievable logic to a lot of things, and that's what has captured my attention to your approach to back problems. Unfortunately, we're halfway through the program already, Dr. McGill. I need to take a very short break, and then we'll be back and we'll continue to discuss this some more. I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll rejoin our guest, Dr. Stuart McGill, and our topic is back pain. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and my guest today is Dr. Stuart McGill. Our topic is kind of the origins, prevention, and rehabilitation of back pain. And if you've got questions or comments, our number is line, or our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as you just heard, if you're listening between 7 and 8, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we won't be able to take your calls or questions at that time. And also, I want to just remind people, if you're coming in at the middle of this, you can go to alaskapublic.org and listen to the program at any time. I think it would help a lot in a program like today's to hear this from the beginning, as we are changing and are hearing a little bit different idea of how we should be approaching and understanding back pain from one of the world's authorities who's researched this issue quite a bit. It bears under a good listening to and understanding, and you certainly can go there at any time. And on our website, there are links to his website, some books that he has written, as well as some videos if you'd like to see it, this information in a slightly different format. Dr. McGill, I'm one of those victims of someone who's had some significant low back pain that actually led to surgery. And one of the things I learned while I was laying in bed trying to fix things instead of probably being up and active, as I think you would tell me to be, was that that we all think these fancy x-rays and MRIs help, and obviously they do help, but there's actually not really always good correlation between those people like myself who had quite a bit of pain and those people who don't have much pain when we look at some of these MRIs. That is, some people have pretty bad-looking backs and don't have much pain, and some people have pretty good-looking backs on X-ray and have quite a bit of pain. Is that true, and what comments might you have about that?
It's absolutely true, and I think I can offer a rational explanation. When you look at the natural history of back pain, generally speaking, it's quite common that it starts with injury or damage to the disc. It may or may not be the disc that's causing the pain, because that disc injury changes the mechanics of the joint. But let's just take this as a typical history. Someone has sat for a bit or sat too much. They've lifted some heavy loads, and they created that original disc bulge, or perhaps they got an implate fracture. Now they've put more load on the facet joints, because the disc is a little bit flatter. In a couple of years, the facet joints become a little bit more grumpy. They're starting to hypertrophy, get a bit arthritic, which is all seen on the MRI image. And now, whereas in the first 2 years, they would have episodic, very nasty episodes of back pain that would last for about 2 weeks. And for the next 3 or 4 months, they might be quite fine. This is all early stage discogenic back pain. But then they'll find, in 2 or 3 years, they've got this generally grumpy back now, and all motion starts to hurt, particularly laying on their back in more extended upright positions, indicating perhaps some facet issues. And then perhaps the bulge starts to rub on a nerve root, and they start getting numb feelings in their legs and this kind of thing. In the whole process of this, their MRIs get worse and worse and worse. Well, if they're lucky enough to live long enough, what will happen is those joints will gristle. They'll slowly fuse. They'll look just awful, terribly degenerated backs. And yet, the good news is all the pain is now gone, because those micro movements, the tissues now bearing load that weren't supposed to bear that much, have stiffened. The pain is now gone. So the good news is the pain goes down, but the MRI continues to look worse. So that's why we get this, at least one of the major reasons why there's this great dichotomy or divergence in what you might see on an MR image. And the number of tragic stories I could tell where surgeons or people got excited about the MRI image and the surgeon operated on what they saw on the image, not realizing that there were two or three levels above that were in the same condition, that they never confirmed that where their knife was directed to was the actual source of the pain, so whether or not they had a good chance to cut the pain out, literally. But I've also seen it go the other way as well. So anyway, I hope that gives some perspective on, I'm not saying MRs are not valuable. Right. In most patients, they're not warranted, in my opinion. But absolutely, they're needed to guide the surgeon.
Yeah.
They do show some interesting, well, for example, we all have been going through the NHL lockout for the last few months. Kind of interesting from a social perspective. The younger fellas seem to go to Europe to make some money, and the older fellas took the time to heal their body. Well, I saw a few of them, and it was interesting that being NHL players, they came with quite a long history of MRI images. So it was a wonderful study to see how their backs and their MRIs had changed over the last 4 or 5 years. And you could just see this natural history, which started out as perhaps an early end plate fracture, and how that eventually ended up into two vertebrae rubbing on one another as the disc was completely flattened, and all sorts of edema occurring in the vertebra, or essentially a bone bruise, so that everything they did now was painful, whereas 4 or 5 years ago, with the original damage, the pain was quite different. But it was so interesting to link symptoms with, right, with the progressive changes in MRs over the years. Anyway, so for those kinds of things, very interesting for study and understanding the history of the patient. But how it actually helps making therapeutic non-surgical decisions, sometimes they're not very helpful.
Yeah, well put, the way you put that. Here's an email that I got, and again, I understand that you may want to just, best you can do is a general bit of advice, but let me see what you have to say. This is a lady who has called and says, for several years, my back has been getting worse in spite of walking 4 to 5 days every day and doing back exercises. She doesn't explain what exercises she's doing. If I bend over too far, I feel a chunk in my spine as though something just popped out of place, and this is followed by several severe muscle spasms for 5 or 6 days. For several years, I did a lot of demanding physical labor, like lumberjacking, even though she is a petite woman, she says. I've now lost the ability to do many back strengthening exercises, can no longer tie my shoes, for example, but I'm still able to walk several miles a day. Does this sound like maybe disc bulging out of, if I make the wrong move? She wonders if that sounding is a bulging disc, and what kind of thoughts would you offer her?
Well, let me give a general, generic commentary, and then my thoughts specifically for her. She gives us lots of clues. One of the clues is that she has what's called instability catches in the normal range of motion. So if you move your spine a certain way, it will clunk. Now that clunk is very indicative of an unstable spine, which is usually a flattened disc that when you move through a certain range of motion, it physically shifts or clunks at the micro level and will give a shot of pain as the nerve is trapped. So what that indicates to me is that she is probably not doing the correct exercises, nor has she learned to move in a way to avoid those unstable events. Here's just a thought, if she's listening. If she could stiffen her abdominal muscles, now I don't mean crushing her back with enormous levels of contraction, but you stiffen to create control. Stiffen the muscles a little bit and then move the spine through that same range of motion where previously she thought she might have an instability catch. Sometimes that stiffness adds control and the clunk is now gone. So there's one hint. But my second hint would be, why is she moving and tying her shoe and moving her back through the range of motion? What we do, and we've designed these movement patterns, we call them movement tools. If she's bending down to tie her shoe, now I'm being very frivolous when I say this, but the patient deserves their pain. And I don't mean that in a derogative way. What I mean that is she's moving in a way that allowed the chance for the pain to occur. If she did a lunge, so stand up nice and tall, and we know walking and standing does not hurt her, which again is classic discogenic symptomology. Stand and then put your foot up on a stool, a nice high stool. Now, you still haven't bent your back, and you're not, at no risk of pain yet. Now, lunge forward, keeping your body upright, but move your hips towards your foot until you can reach your foot or work boot or whatever it is and tie it. Your body is still upright. So there would be using the lunge movement tool to tie your shoe. Or to say, go down on your knees and start to do some floor exercises and that kind of thing. But we would also teach a squat tool, which I've already described, that shortstop squat. We would use what we call a torsional buttressing tool, which allows you to pull open heavy doors and push objects and whatnot in a way that's very conserving of the spine and uses your hips and shoulders and that kind of thing. So there was a general generic comment on the likelihood that those symptoms would be discogenic, and then something very specific for her to think about. But I wish I knew a little bit more about the current exercises that she's doing.
Right.
And I suspect we might be able to hone those a little bit.
And is it reasonable to ask you those exercises would be better if they're more core strengthening and not related to bending, such as sit-ups?
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, so many stories here. As you're probably aware, there's been a fair amount of media attention on some of the statements I've made about sit-ups and how inappropriate they are for back health. And then, someone will write in and say, oh, well, McGill is an idiot or he's off base because we just looked on YouTube and saw some fellow in Brazil who did 30,000 consecutive sit-ups and he didn't have disc bulges. Well, you know, I can tell you about the fellow who can do 30,000 sit-ups simply because he did them, and we know that he will be a small person with a slender spine. So you can bend a slender rod over and over, and you get less fatigue in it. But if you take a big, thick rod and try and bend it, the stresses will be so large it breaks. It's like a large, hollow tree. You can't bend it, and yet it's incredibly strong. So if this woman is heavier boned and has a thicker spine, sit-ups would be absolutely inappropriate for her. But if we were to do, we call it the McGill Modified Curl-Up, it's on YouTube, have a peek at it, but make sure it's the DVDs that we've produced and not some of the knockoff ones where people never got the exercise right and they slaughter the technique. But, you know, there's other things. A simple push-up is a tremendous abdominal exercise that requires core stiffness, and I'm if you don't mind that, I'm going to replace your word core strengthening with core stiffening.
Okay, right.
Now, a progression of that exercise would be stir the pot. So if you can imagine, folks know what I mean by the large gym ball or the stability ball. Have your feet on the ground like you're going to do a push-up, shoulder width apart, and then put your elbows on the stability ball. The hands are clasped together, and then simply stir your elbows around like you're stirring the pot, and you'll find that is a tremendous abdominal challenge, but it's building core stiffness and core endurance primarily because that's what will reduce the pain. You'll get stronger, there's no question, and that will transfer to pushing and pulling and creating that guy wire system that we were talking about at the beginning of our session today. But move us towards giving some insight to your thought?
Yeah, I think I keep hearing the same information is that there's it really does get down to being exactly sure what's going on. And then developing the program that rehabilitates the problem that's happened. So it's very, very difficult for Dr. McGill to give precise answers, but we're trying to get the idea out here of a different way of thinking about this spine that we have, that perhaps not all of us, but many of us have been told about how to handle our problems. I'm not saying that as well as I should, but I think it's important that people go to look at more of the information you have and then get a very good diagnosis before we get
too
far.
Can I offer a short opinion on this?
Absolutely.
Yeah. This, I think you've hit the nail on the head, and we've seen study after study on low back pain. Well, could you imagine, say, in your area of pediatrics, and we didn't talk about back pain, but we talked about leg pain. And if I were to say to you, what do you do for a 10-year-old who comes in with leg pain? What exercises would you do? Well, you wouldn't know whether it was a fracture, a tumor, vascular claudication, or it was blown off
right.
in an accident, or, without any information, you couldn't give any advice at all about that leg pain. And yet, we see medical articles of people who've done a cohort study and a randomized control trial of people with back pain, and then their conclusion is, well, nothing worked. These exercises were the same as those exercises, it's the same as bed rest and everything else. Well, the problem is you can't treat back pain as a homogeneous medical entity. We all have different causes for our back pain. We're in different stages of the life cycle. We have a different injury history. We have different drug tolerance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And until we subcategorize those the causes of those back pain, we will never converge on what treatment would be best matched for that particular classification of bad back. So I hope that augments what you were saying there.
Yeah. Much better than I said it. Let's take a phone call here. Hopefully this will be a little bit shorter and perhaps we can get a good answer. Robert, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate the doctor's clear Canadian pronunciation. like the previous caller, I've had some of those lower back clanks, painless though, but they're almost auditory. But my core question is, can you, if you take glucosamine and chondroitins, is there any evidence those do anything for you, or do they do anything harmful to you to experience renewal of your spine or ligaments?
Good question. All right.
Wow. Well, first of all, I'm not qualified to talk about anything. I know they're not classed as drugs. I can give you a personal opinion, but that's all it would be. It's not an evidence based. It's certainly outside of my professorial expertise, shall we say. Did you want an opinion on
that? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, again, the rider is that this is all it is. I don't know about the evidence for back conditions. I know of no scientific foundation. Having said that, I will swear by it for the major joints like hips and shoulders. In my own case, I broke my hip as a kid. And I've had a very arthritic right hip. In fact, I was going to have it replaced about 12 years ago. And I met a neurologist at the time, quite a famous Czechoslovakian neurologist named Vladimir Yonda. And he showed how, because of pain, pain causes you to limp in different areas of your body. And certainly there's a syndrome he named for low back pain. If you have back pain, your neurological components preferentially stop using the back, the gluteal muscles to extend your hips, and they preferentially use the hamstrings. And we just proved that, by the way, in a hospital study. But to cut to the chase with glucosamine and chondroitin, he showed me these corrective exercises to reprofile the gluteal muscles of my hips, which unloaded the hip joint and the arthritic components. But I also started taking glucosamine, chondroitin, and MSM. It's a cocktail, 500 milligrams, 400, and 400. I also can see my own hip on X-ray. And we do this almost yearly, and I can prove that the cartilage has grown back where it was a hole in my cartilage before, and I can also prove that the bone spurs around the joint have shrunk. Now, I don't think that's the glucosamine. I think that's the corrective exercises in reducing the load on the joint. The bone spurs shrunk. So I mentioned this to one of my orthopedic surgeon friends who happens to run a very large orthopedic journal, and he says, yep, he's seen it as well in a select subgroup of patients. So the all very personal opinion. I will say that I certainly have seen enough case study evidence that I'm convinced in certain populations, now this might be way off topic, but yeah, I think you're well aware that different haplogroups and genetic groups in the world handle drugs, compounds, alcohol, etc. They handle them differently. I'm convinced that the Celtic haplogroup does well on glucosamine and chondroitin. All personal opinion.
Okay. Thanks
anyway, that's way out of my comfort zone as a scientist and as a professor to even say that. But I there's some personal thoughts for you.
All right, let's try another call. Beth, you're on line one.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling because I had a fusion done in my neck. I had 3 vertebrae and 2 discs removed, and 3 vertebrae were fused. And following the surgery, I was advised that I probably shouldn't continue to use an inversion table. And prior to the surgery, I have one at home and really appreciated what it did for my back. And I'm just wondering what the doctor thinks about using inversion tables. Is that something I potentially could use? And is an inversion table good for general back health?
I'm assuming, because I don't know what an inversion table is myself, I'm guessing it's one of those things you put your ankles in and you turn yourself upside down.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, nope. Thanks.
Okay, well, I have several opinions on this. First of all, I'm not a cervical spine or a neck expert. My expertise really is limited to the low back. But having said that, we did do an inversion study probably about 20 years ago. And what it showed was that if you hang, the traction load in your back does cause the spine to grow, and it appears to be growing by sucking fluid back into the discs. And then when you stand up and walk around in gravity once again, that added height that was gained is gone in about 15 minutes. Well, the discs are avascular structures, and they get their nutrition by this diurnal variation in height. So when you go to bed at night, your discs suck up fluid and you actually grow overnight. But that's how they get their nutrition. So the inversion table on one hand could be quite reasonably described as giving a feeding to the discs. however, having said all of that, if the elongated discs have added a bit of disc space to take pressure off nerve roots and whatnot, if it does that, it probably is a very transient 15-minute or so effect. But also, there are patients who will complain about headache and pressure in their eyes and that kind of thing with your head well below your feet. If I can, Ted, can I give one more comment on this?
Absolutely.
Yes. There are some studies to show that not so much the inversion table, but sort of traction tables where you're more horizontal and they put a load on your rib cage towards your head and then on your feet the other way to traction your back a little bit. The scientific evidence, in at least as I'm interpreting it, shows no real effect, long-term effect, on many people And my bias on that is that it probably doesn't remove the cause of their pain. It just treats short-term symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, there's a subgroup of back pained people who tend to be older. So these are the older arthritic types of spines, and the traction loads have been shown as a group effect to have some efficacy with those older folks. So there you go. That's about all I know about traction loads and inversion.
Well, again, there's a lot more to it than you really begin to think about. And what your comments made me think about something I think I read in one of your recommendations is that when we get up first thing in the morning, actually our discs are somewhat swollen. They've been a little bit better hydrated, and so that actually can be detrimental sometimes to doing certain activities first thing in the morning.
Well, absolutely. That's a scientific fact. When we go to bed at night, people will find it quite easy to take their socks off. And yet when they wake up in the morning, they find it quite difficult to put them on. And the reason is your discs have sucked up fluid throughout the night, and they're actually quite swollen. So the same bend in your spine of putting your socks on compared to taking them off the night before, that bend is like a water balloon, very full and ready to burst. And the bending stresses are three times higher first thing in the morning than to take your socks off at night. So it's not imagined. It's very, very real. And the risk of those with disc bulges of re-herniating a disc is much, much higher. And that also is panned out in the epidemiology. Studies of minors in particular note that the first hour at work, the incidence of that acute disc bulge is much higher when those discs are full.
We have only a little over a minute left, and I always like to leave you or my guest with an opportunity to remind us what are the important things you'd like us to take away from the program today. I also want to briefly apologize to all the calls and emails that we have that we're not getting to. We just had too many. But your last comments, and perhaps we can do this again sometime and get some more questions answered.
Well, my advice is for people to... I'm writing a book right now for the lay public, and it has three parts. The first one is understand the cause of your pain. And if I ask people to write down on a piece of paper the activities that make their pain worse, it becomes quite evident, and the book guides them to interpret the answer to that question. So realize what causes your pain, and then stop the cause. And through several examples, I think we can show people to do that. And then I think most people need a little bit of a hand with assessing the real cause of their back and then figuring out the corrective plan. And there is no single best answer for everybody, unfortunately. It's not so easy. You have to isolate that cause and deal with it as an individual. Can I make one more comment?
Sure.
I have to tell you how much I've enjoyed this, and your really thoughtful style. I see why you do this. You're really good at it.
Well,
thanks very much. I do a lot of interviews, and you're top of the game. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We're just trying to get the best information to our listeners we can. Have a great day.
Thank you so much.
All right, my thanks to Dr. Stuart McGill, professor of spine biomechanics at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. You can continue this conversation on Facebook, and you can find that link at our website, alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to talk about medical ethics, particularly pediatric bioethics, with Dr. Doug Dikema of the University of Washington in Seattle Children's Hospital. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. As usual, we'll repeat at 7 p.m. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack helped me today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.